And this is Beryl Wiseman sitting in for my good friend Jim Duff. I'm really privileged to be talking to this next lady. I'm also happy that we finally connected after trying for 4 or 5 days. So this is a little taste of the Last Angry Man show, which is coming up right after this, which I'll be here for, of course. Now, as many of you remember, back a week, 10 days ago, the Institute for Public Affairs, which I'm president of, ran a conference called Questions of Values. What are the values that we are prepared to draw on the sand in the line on in dealing with the Islamist challenge? And Laura Notes, who's vice president of the Calgary-based Canadian Women for Women in Afghanistan, and please go to their website, Canadian Women for Women in Afghanistan, and she managed the CETA-funded Women's Rights in Afghanistan Fund from 2002 to 2006, puts it very plainly. You can't share a table with the Taliban because women's rights would be negotiated out of existence. She said negotiating with them as a fallback measure is a poor excuse for a failure so far to provide real security and development for Afghans. Laura Notes, welcome. Them's fighting words. And, you know, more and more, all my guests from the West seem to have a storehouse of reason and sanity. And then there's, you know, the Jack Laytons, and I told you when we spoke earlier, who I keep asking and I don't get an answer, when he says we should talk to the Taliban, and I say, Jack, what do you want to talk to them about? Whether they shoot you as a socialist or cut your head off as a trade unionist?
I notice the NDP tends to, they make a statement and then they come up with answers after they've been questioned on that when people tell them it doesn't make sense. So we try to be more reasonable here out West.
Lauren, talk to us about Women for Women in Afghanistan. How did it start?
It started 10 years ago, so this is our 10th anniversary, the year that the Taliban took over Afghanistan and started imposing the edicts against women. And it started as a very grassroots movement, and it remains so today, by a group of women in Calgary, and then it spread like wildfire across the country. And it today has 14 chapters, so you can probably find a chapter in your own city. And what we do is two major things. The first is we raise funds for projects that we support on the ground in Afghanistan, which are run by Afghan women, healthcare projects, education, skills training, empowerment, human rights training, things like that. And then the second thing we do is we try to raise awareness among Canadians about what is happening in terms of the human rights and security situation for women and girls there, which was a difficult job to do before 2001, a lot easier after September 11th, and then becoming a bit more difficult now as, Afghanistan slips on and off people's radar screens. So our jobs follow that same parallel.
How frustrating is it? I know it's frustrating for me on political discussions, whether I'm giving a speech or whether I'm on air, but Do you feel a frustration in explaining to people that, look, the Afghanistan mission and Canada's participation is not a failure? Yes, you're seeing Kandahar province, but the rest of the country, it's not a war. We're there to help construct a society where today girls don't get acid thrown in their faces for going to school and women aren't beheaded for having adulterous affairs. Are you getting the feeling that Canadians aren't getting the full message about the 90% of Afghanistan that has been reconstructed?
It's frustrating, and what people need to understand is that it takes time, especially in the context of Afghanistan. This is a country that has been through over a quarter of a century of violent conflict, and that's a really long time. And what happens is it means the consequences of conflict become entrenched in, you know, the way the country looks physically, but also the culture of the country, and that's really hard to reverse. So we almost have to be in for the same amount of time as the conflict went on. We need to be there for 20 years or more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a commitment that we've got responsibility towards, and we really have to stick to it and be patient and, you know, wait for the investment we've made there to pan out.
It seems that when an organization draws attention to Islamist fundamentalism and the Islamist challenge based on a particularity or on a specificity, I should say, as you've done with Afghanistan, and of course the visible symbol was the burqa. As Nazanin Afsanjan, your fellow Vancouverite, drew attention to the plight of women in Iran on the case of Nazanin Fatehi, the young 16-year-old girl who was sentenced to death for stabbing the man who was raping her because there weren't four male witnesses to the rape. So she was sentenced to death because she shamed her family. Do you find that when you get specific, as opposed to the big geopolitical military discussions, when organizations get specific about specific countries and specific violations, that captures the popular imagination quicker and easier?
It's a challenge because, you know, we're focused on the women's perspective there. What do women need now? We ask Afghan women all the time before we go out and speak on their behalf. But what happens is, you know, one symbol of a people kind of gets scooped up by the media and then used to represent them. In Afghanistan, that's the burqa. You know, we really associate the plight of Afghan women with the burqa.
There were more. There were 3% of women getting educated. Today, I believe the figure is closer to 70%. There was a whole range of things. No representation in government, no voting rights, no property rights, no family rights in divorce, a whole range of things.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of progress made, and actually Afghanistan has more women in its parliaments than Canada does.
That's correct. I just saw that the other day.
That's something we often forget. The security situation is what's restricting women the most right now and really preventing them from accessing the rights that they've now been guaranteed under the new constitution. But Afghanistan is a complicated place because it's extremely diverse. It has several different ethnic groups, 32 languages. It's very mountainous, so certain parts of the country are very cut off from other parts. And it's almost like a whole bunch of different countries. So you have to approach each province and sometimes each village on its own terms.
That's an excellent point, and I want to pursue that. We're just going to take a short break. We'll be right back with Lauren Oates of Women for Women in Afghanistan. And this is Beryl Wiseman sitting in for Jim Duff for the balance of the drive with Duff. And pleasure to speak to Lauren Oates, Vice President of Calgary-based Canadian Women for Women in Afghanistan. Check out their website. Just Google it. Don't Google it. Lauren, what's the website? It's W4W.
www.w4, as in the digit 4.
The number, right.
Afghan.ca. So that's W4WAfghan.ca.
Before the break, you were starting to talk about the diversity of Afghanistan, and this is one thing that I try to point out to a lot of people, and I'm sure you do too. The Afghanistan experiment in social reconstruction is working a lot better than Iraq. It's a lot more sophisticated, a group of leaders, more sophisticated president, and a much more representative government. Is this something that you've got to constantly point out to people?
Because they
tend to lump everything in that area as the same?
Yeah, we often say it's just impossible to compare the two. They're such different contexts. But Afghanistan had the whole Soviet occupation experience,
right,
which really differentiates it from Iraq. And I think they're two very different conflicts. Also, the American involvement differs in each. And I don't know very much about Iraq, and it's hard to say. Afghanistan's not doing a lot better, but it seems to be an improvement over the situation in Iraq.
What happens with the funds you raise? You say it goes to Afghanistan. It goes to particular organizations, or?
Right. Our organization is 100% volunteer.
Right.
We have no paid staff. So we have a board and we have chapters at the local level in Canadian cities, and they raise the money through fundraisers and donations. And then we transfer it directly to our partners, Afghan women's organizations, who then do the projects. And one really innovative fundraising program we have is called the Breaking Bread for Afghan Women. And this is where Canadians get together and their groups of friends and have dinners, potluck dinners, and everyone brings a check. And the idea is that at the end of the night, you'll have raised $750, which is the amount that can pay a teacher's salary for 1 year in Afghanistan.
Amazing.
And then they send that to us, and we send it to schools. And you can actually go on the website of Breaking Bread. It's breakingbreadforwomen.com. And see a few weeks after your dinner took place exactly what school your money went to and the name of the teacher whose salary you paid.
Superb. Tell me, what motivated you to write the op-ed in the Globe and Mail, which you did recently? And it was last Friday, by the way, and I would recommend that everybody read it. It's called Don't Share a Table with the Taliban. Go to globeandmail.ca and take a look at it. What motivated you to write it now? Why now?
Because there's increasingly calls for negotiations with the Taliban, and this is a really half-baked idea, because it's not that I'm opposed to peace talks or having the Taliban involved at some level, but those that are calling for this as an alternative to the fighting taking place now, haven't really laid out the plan. They haven't thought about what are we willing to compromise, what would we give the Taliban, and who exactly from the Taliban would we negotiate with. And people are forgetting, especially those that don't know much about Afghanistan or haven't been there, that the Taliban is not a unified political movement. It's extremely ambiguous. And you can have one Taliban representative in Kandahar say, yeah, you know, we're cool with women's rights. We're going to start changing our policy on women, and they'll be treated equally, et cetera, et cetera. And then another Taliban spokesman in the north of the country or in Pakistan saying the total opposite. So, you know, they're not unified. They're very ragtag, and there's a lot of Taliban involved for economic reasons only. They switch alliances quickly. So who exactly from this political movement?
Right. Who do you talk to?
Negotiate with.
Exactly. I'm looking at the website, and I want to repeat it again. www.afghan.ca. And under Afghanistan Today, you write, Canadians as global citizens, and we try to make the point both at my institute and on my show, if Canadians are not involved in mankind's transcendent yearning for redemptive change, if they think by social justice stopping at our borders that it won't corrode here, they're wrong. And your words just leap out from the screen at me.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. And, you know, 10 years ago when I first got involved in fighting alongside Afghan women for their rights, that's what hit me, is that this is actually a violation to women anywhere. You have to perceive it as a violation to you, as a threat to you, and not say, oh, it's acceptable that these kinds of things happen to women over there or to whoever over there, and really start, getting rid of the borders in your mind and thinking of the movement on a global level.
You're keeping alive the sentiments of John F. Kennedy when he said, every person's pain diminishes me. Lauren Oates, much congratulations. Keep up this good work. It's important, and it's redemptive, not only for you, it's redemptive for this country.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming on. Well, we're out of time. That brings us to the end of A Drive with Duff. It was great sitting in for Jim the past hour and a half on The Drive with Duff. It got us a good entree, a good segue into what our first topic is going to be, which, of course, is the American election. And the discussion we had with CNN's Ed McCarthy focused on the Rumsfeld resignation, and that we'll be talking about that with our first guest. We're going to be talking about a lot more, and it's my pleasure to welcome the chair of the North American Studies Department at McGill, Professor Thomas Velk. Tom, welcome. I know you got a rushed evening, and I thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Oh, well, great, Farrell. I wouldn't be without a talk tonight, because these are hot items, and I've got all kinds of things to say about them.
I don't know where to start. I don't know whether to start about the split in the Democratic Party, that it's not just the sort of tree-hugging lefties of Nancy Pelosi. I don't know whether to start with Rumsfeld as the sacrificial offering by Bush. You take it. What's the signal of this election?
Well, first of all, I think especially our Canadian audience needs to learn a couple of things about the American political system. In the first place, the Democrats really can't do very much, if anything at all, vis-a-vis Mr. Bush's prosecution of the war. He's the commander-in-chief, and all the Democrats could do in Congress is deny funding to the war, and they wouldn't dare do that because it would be seen to be critical or non-supportive of the troops. So I'm really kind of surprised that Rumsfeld would have walked, because whatever it is that Rumsfeld wants to do, he'd continue to be able to do no matter what the Pelosis of the world say. And, of course, to follow up on your point, the Pelosis of the world were not the kind of Democrats that got elected. The Democrats that got elected were mainly, you take an example, this guy Jim Webb down in Virginia, who's probably going to be...
They're contesting that on November 27th. We'll see that.
Right. But a lot of these guys are very conservative guys.
Yeah, and that's one of the interesting things. A lot of people were talking about this election as a war referendum. Yet Joe Lieberman gets elected as an independent, pro-war in Connecticut, which is a soft-on-the-war state. And it's very possible that Joe Tester in Montana will be elected as a pro-war Democrat. He's not against the war. He's against the prosecution of the war. He'd like to see more troops. So how this works out in the Congress will be very interesting.
Well, I think that's exactly right. You know, a lot of the war critics on both sides of the aisle, but on the Republican in particular, are critical in the sense that they figure the war is being fought with much too political correctness. It hasn't been fought aggressively enough, and they haven't dealt with these so-called innocent civilians aggressively enough, because these mobs in the street that are chanting "Hate America" are as much a part of the enemy, at least as far as a guy like I am concerned, as are the official combatants.
Tom, have you got time to stay with us for a short break? I want to ask you a technical question on how the Congress operates, and I think our listeners should understand the difference between a parliamentary system and what they've got down there, if you've got the time.
Oh, yeah, sure, be happy to.
We'll be right back with Tom Velk.
Okay.
And we're back with Professor Thomas Velk, Chair of the North American Studies Department at McGill. It's so great, Tom, to have you as a guest, because I can have you as an economist, as a political commentator. You're the man for all seasons.
Let's pretend to be.
You do a good job. Let's get Canadians to understand, because when we have an election here, we've got this lockstep gridlock system where MPs have to follow the leader, and that's not true in the States, is it?
Well, absolutely not. There's an immense amount of independent power, and individual legislators, even though they call themselves Democrats or Republicans, vary a great deal. One of the issues that Canada's going to have to face is that the Democrats who are the chairs of the big committees are still the old-time lefties, and they are going to be, among other things, anti-free trade, and they might give Canada a lot of trouble with our
on stuff policy. Like on beef policies. They were the ones that would have opposed a softwood lumber agreement.
Exactly. They're terrible people from the point of view of being open-minded on immigration and trade, and for that matter, Canadian relations that have an economic component. They are protectionists. Now, on the other hand, the junior Democrats that are coming in are less ideological in that way, but we have to wait 20 years before they get some seniority.
Now, we know that in the House, the Republicans the Democrats have a good 30-seat lead. The Senate is still up in the air and to be determined. But a lot of these people that were elected are not the tree-hugging, chattering class salon liberals. What do you think? I mean, was it my misimpression, or was the president flustered in his press conference today?
Well, yeah.
And was that an overreaction to the quality of the individuals elected rather than the party?
I think he was, and I think it may even have been that the Rumsfeld resignation was something of a surprise even to the president, because I don't think he was trying to fool anybody when he said last week that Mr. Rumsfeld was going to stay on. Rumsfeld may very well feel that, okay, you guys that have been criticizing, see if you can do better than I have done. Which is an understandable reaction on his part. But the key thing about that Rumsfeld resignation is that it's the president who makes policy internationally, and it's the president who's commander-in-chief. And the only reason that Rumsfeld stayed on as long as he did was because he had the confidence of the president. And I think the president's strategies are not going to change with respect to the war or with respect to the election either.
Now, the president made clear that there are a lot of common ground, as he put it, that can be found on things like minimum wage. But on the prosecution of the war, he's prepared to talk tactics, not strategy. Now, can he get away with that, or is Nancy Pelosi, the California congresswoman, who'll be probably the next speaker, going to really push it hard on this issue as a defining issue for the new Democrats, as they call themselves?
Well, she can scream, rend her garments, wring her hanky, pound her little feet on the floor, but it's not going to do a bit of good because, one, he's the commander-in-chief. Two, all the House can do is try to cut funding. They don't dare cut funding because it would be seen to be undermining the troops. And, moreover, now that she has some kind of a responsibility instead of just a platform, she can't talk as crazy as she used to. And she's going to have to suggest, if she's going to do anything at all, policies rather than just be one of the old nattering nabobs to say that he's doing the wrong thing. She's got to come up with something positive, and I haven't heard a word of positive suggestion from the Democratic side yet.
No, it's been opposing for the sake of opposing. I'm reminded of what Bobby Kennedy said when he announced his candidacy for the presidency, and he said, "I run not merely to oppose any man, but to propose new policies." And somehow something's gone out of the Democratic Party as far as proposing new policies.
Well, that's right. There is one idea out of Joe Biden, of all people, having to do with partition, which a number of people are talking about. It may be a kind of the de facto solution for the war, not particularly a good one. But I think that what's not well recognized is that in a way, one half to two thirds of the Iraq has already been stabilized. The north at Kurdistan is perfectly stable, and the south is not that bad. It's really in the middle.
And we were just talking with Lauren Oates about that, about Afghanistan, and we're not getting the full picture that, yeah, Kandahar's a tough mission. Yeah, Baghdad's got a lot of Shiites and Sunnis killing themselves, but they're not looking at the rest of the stuff. 33,000 new businesses set up, 90% of the kids who've been vaccinated against polio, three quarters of the girls going to school, all hospitals running properly. That we're not hearing about.
Exactly. Bechtel is just leaving Iraq, not because they're quitting, but because they finished the job with respect to rebuilding an immense amount of infrastructure all over the country. It's only in places like Baghdad where they keep blowing it up as fast as they can build it. But in many places, the infrastructure is in place and is operating and is providing a reasonable life, especially in these in the north and the south. If we, my suggestion for strategy is that we should grab those oil revenues and parcel them out to the peaceable people, to the Kurds in the north, and to a degree to the people in the south, and withhold every nickel from the Sunnis and the Shias that are fighting each other, and say, listen, you can keep killing each other as long as you want, but you're not going to get a nickel of that oil money until you settle down.
I think what Canadians have to know also about the American system historically in the past 100 years, almost every president who's in the midterm election of his second term, which is the last term that normally they have, except for Franklin Roosevelt, has taken a hit, both in the Senate and the House. And they shouldn't necessarily expect a fold here. It's going to be an interesting couple of years until the presidential elections, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of grist for the mill for people like you and certainly for people like me, and I know we'll be talking about this again.
We sure will, Beryl. One last shot. The one danger that the elections present for Mr. Bush is that if the Senate goes Democrat, he's going to have a tough time naming reasonable judges. That will be a problem.
That will.
But the rest of the election, really, in terms of the war particularly, is not going to touch him.
Although, interestingly enough, even if they win both Virginia and Montana, and if both Virginia and Montana go Democrat, you're going to have 51, you're going to have 50 Democrats, 49 Republicans, and you're going to have one independent, Joe Lieberman.
Right. Well, there's another so-called independent, a guy out of Vermont.
Bernie Sanders, of course.
Sanders, who is kind of a member of the nut left.
Who you know very well, though. And a Brooklyn carpenter. This man has been a congressman for 15 years, self-styled socialist.
Yes. And really, he's kind of a guy out of a time machine from the 1960s, a kind of lefty. But Joe Lieberman's going to be in the catbird seat there, and I think he's the kind of guy that, of course, the president can make a deal with, for especially for these key things like judgeships. So it's going to mean Joe is going to be a very significant player for the next little while, and the left radicals in the Democratic Party that tried to kill him are going to regret having done so.
Tom Velk, many thanks for your time. I know you got a tight evening. Enjoy the rest of it.
I sure will, Beryl. Thanks for the shot.
Always a pleasure. Montreal, Canada. We'll be right back. Now, the American election isn't the only one to have an impact on our world. And our world can be described globally as this little blue dot floating in space. But let's discuss it continentally. We've had guests over the past 10 days discussing the situation in Venezuela and Brazil, particularly. The difference between two leftist leaders, one in Brazil, respected by the world community and having built a consensus, and the other in Venezuela, not a little less responsible. And we're going to be talking about those elections and the election of Daniel Ortega, the former Sandinista rebel leader in Nicaragua, later in the hour with Dr. Robert Pastor of American University in Washington. But right now we're going to something else that has nothing to do with freedom and has nothing to do with elections. It has to do with what the name of the title is, Obsession, Radical Islam's War Against the West. It's going to be shown tomorrow night, and I'm pleased to have with me the co-president of the Beitar Association in Montreal, Josh Rosenblum, who's a master's student at McGill, who the Beitar is hosting this screening. And this is an important film. Glenn Beck at CNN News did two nights on this, calling it Obsession, without exaggeration, one of the most important films of our time. It was a winner of the Best Feature Film Liberty Film Festival, and it deals with its subtitle, Radical Islam's War Against the West. Josh Rosenblum, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're showing this at McGill. We know in Montreal the problems that have occurred whenever even speakers want to show up on a campus discussing this issue. How did you guys pull this off?
Well, we had to make sure that McGill campus security was going to be there. And these guys aren't just any form of security. They know the code of conduct back and forth. So anybody that causes a ruckus is getting shown the door.
Now, you're a master's student at McGill. What are you studying?
I'm in the sociology master's at McGill.
Any repercussions, any comments to you from fellow students?
No, you know, I generally like to be very open about this stuff, and I present myself in such a way that, you know, just coming across as another opinion. My professors last year at the University of Toronto actually all found out. They read the campus newspaper, and they were pretty receptive to these ideas.
The over 1 billion people have watched the Obsession special that I mentioned, by the way, when I quoted Glenn Beck. 1 billion viewers around the world.
Wow.
Now, this movie is going to be introduced, or there'll be a lecture, correct me if I'm wrong, by Professor Salim Mansour from the University of Western Ontario, who also is on the board of the Canadian Coalition for Democracies. And he's coming
yep.
in tomorrow night, I believe?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
So what's the setup of the evening? He'll be speaking first, or the movie will go on first?
Well, my co-president and I, Sarah Rodier, we're going to say a few words, have some of our co-sponsors come up, and then Professor Mansour is going to come and discuss not only the film, but his own academic perspectives on radical Islamic regimes in the Middle East.
Josh, please stay with us. We've got to take a short break, and I want to discuss with you the background of the film and its importance and its history throughout the world. Montreal will be right back. And we're talking with Josh Rosenblum, co-president of Montreal Beitar. He's a master's student at McGill, and Beitar is sponsoring the screening of Obsession tomorrow night at McGill. It'll be accompanied by a lecture from Professor Salim Mansour of the University of Western Ontario and a member of the Canadian Coalition for Democracies. Now, should anybody think that Obsession is some kind of piece of propaganda? It's not. It was made by top-flight filmmakers Wayne Copping and Raphael Shore. It's gotten praise from all circles and all, not just media, but people in the public eye, people like Mary Matlin, former assistant to the president and counselor to Vice President Cheney, Frank Gaffney Jr., president of the Center for Security Policies, on and on and on and on. Josh, this screening, the film itself is just based, really, on what is being shown throughout the radical Muslim world. It's not a propaganda ploy. It's what the Palestinian Authority is showing its people. It's what the training films are being shown in Saudi Arabia, in Iran, throughout the Al-Qaeda network. What has made this film so compelling? We've seen a lot of this stuff before. What's made it so compelling that a billion people tuned into CNN to see it?
Well, I think the clips that they show from the different media coming out of these, you know, radical regimes in the Middle East, it's really telling of the disparity between our public spheres in North America and in the Orient. In terms of how many people have gone to see it, well, I mean, I can only endorse the movie so far, but, I mean, the numbers speak for themselves.
They certainly do. Josh, it'll be shown where tomorrow?
It's going to be at Leacock Building, room 219 at McGill University. And let me just remind everyone that admission is complimentary and there are intermission refreshments as well.
And it's it starts at what time?
6 p.m.
Josh, stay with us. Our lines are filling up. Let's just try to cool down the lines a bit. Jacob, welcome.
Yeah, good evening to you.
Good evening.
Yeah, I think there's some important points you're missing here. You're in the same vein of thinking that other politically correct people are, unfortunately.
Wait a minute, you're calling me politically correct?
Well,
that's
actually,
a first. I want your name, address, and I want a quote. I'm going to put it on a plaque.
Well, let me just point out.
Okay, wait a minute. I want to repeat that. Jacob has called me politically correct, okay? You lefties, you tree huggers out there. I'm politically correct. Okay, Jacob, tell me why.
No. I don't think generally you are, but on this point, I'm afraid you're leaving out certain key bits of information.
Shoot.
Now, I had a chance to meet a Coptic 2 years ago, and he knows Arabic, and he's read the Quran. Did you know, for example, that there are no universally accepted legal standards in Islam? That means that what Ayatollah Khomeini did, what Mullah Omar is doing, what Bin Laden is doing, is all perfectly acceptable.
And let's, just for our audience, Mullah Omar is the head of the Taliban.
That's right. So in other words, there's no such thing, strictly speaking, as radical Islam. As a matter of fact, there's
Where I'm politically correct.
That's
right.
There's no such thing as moderate Islam either. Now wait a minute, I'm getting to this.
You know, I got this from three women last week at the Institute conference on questions of values, ways of response to the Islamist challenge. Three of the four speakers refused to make a distinction. Bridget Gabriel, Nani Darwish, and Wafa Sultan refused to make a distinction. And I got this from them, so you're just piling on to three women ahead of you, Jacob.
Well, listen, if you want to prove it to yourself, don't have to believe me. You just ask an expert in Islam and ask him straightforward, are there any universally accepted legal standards besides the fact they pray five times a day, they fast on Ramadan, whatever?
No, you're quite right. Okay. But the point, the differentiation I would make is the following. The problem with the Islamic world has been that there's never been a separation between state and faith.
That's right.
They've never had that. And Sharia law is Sharia law. The difference I would, and it's a subtle difference, I grant you, is the following. That there are regimes and leaders who, in their execution and propagation of Sharia law,
mm-hmm.
Take that to an extreme, while there are other leaders that are trying to basically say to their populations, and there aren't many, like, cool your jets. Okay, yeah, we got Sharia, but, you know, like, let's cool it.
But they're both 100% kosher, if you like, Islam. Now, the other point...
Well, let's say halal.
Okay, halal, whatever. Now, let's...
Josh, you can jump right in here. You don't have to just laugh.
All right, just...
Hey, I'm getting called politically correct. I love this. I'm not saying anything.
All right, just one more point, if I may, please.
You certainly can.
All right. Now,
as a matter of fact, we can continue. Let me just take a short break and pay some bills before I get whacked here and the victim of a jihad. And we'll be right back with both of you, Jacob on the line and Josh Rosenblum of Baytar Montreal. And for cell phone users, let me remind you, *940 for Rogers and #940 for Bell users. And we've got Josh Rosenblum, co-president of Baytar Montreal, master student at McGill, who's presenting Obsession tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at the Stephen Leacock, at the Leacock Arts Building. And we're on the line with Jacob, who's called me politically correct. I love this.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. No, I'm pulling your leg, but I...
Okay.
Go ahead. You had another point to make.
There's another very interesting point this Coptic told me about. Apparently, when Muhammad first presented the Quran, it spoke of peace and love and all that, okay? When people refused his overtures, in particular the Jews in a place called Khyber on the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, he murdered them. And then he changed, he added verses, he called these the cancelled verses. In other words, he put in verses which spoke about chopping the heads off of infidels, carrying out a physically violent jihad. And these verses he wrote cancelled the previous ones. Now many Muslims don't know about this, and others who do, you know, kind of push it aside. So the next time you have an Islamic expert, ask him, point out this particular point about the cancelled verses. And finally, I'd like to raise this point with you. You
well,
know, you
would think, can I jump in?
Yeah, sure, Josh. Go ahead.
Regarding the first one, the terminology of radical versus moderate Islam, let's just remind ourselves that these are not sects or denominations of a religious nature, but political terms we use to describe the social movements themselves and their own goals and aspirations, right? I think what you're doing is you're taking our political conversation into the realm of religion, which is certainly not what we'd want to do, because clearly what's going on in the Middle East today is of a political nature. They're using this ideology of Islam and distorting it.
Right, but what you're saying, of course, if you remember at the beginning of our conversation, Islam does not see a difference between social and religious values. They're both the same. Political, religious, they're all one, okay?
Right. Well,
and number two...
Unfortunately, in the West, there is a separation of church and state. And for our listeners out there, they make these distinctions which are not readily available to those who don't know about radical Islam.
Guys, I got to cut this short because we're running up against the clock. I just want to ask Josh a final question. I don't know if you had relations with the press. What do you hope to see out of the screening? What kind of attitude change? What message and to whom?
I hope that people recognize that you do not have to apologize for your convictions, and that if you are worried about terrorism in Canada, this is a justified concern, and we want to show that people are standing up and talking about it.
Josh Rosenblum, thanks very much, and good luck tomorrow night.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. As we said at the top of the hour, it's not just the American election that affects all of us on this little blue ball that's floating through space. Central Latin America is critical. We've examined on several occasions the difference between the Venezuelan and Brazilian governments, even though both claims to be left-leaning and socialist. We've seen the election just this week of Daniel Ortega, the former leader of the Sandinista rebels in Nicaragua, who fought a bloody civil war, who now promises a different kind of government. And we're privileged to have with us Dr. Robert Pastor, Vice President of International Affairs and Director for the Center of Democracy and Election Management at American University in Washington. Dr. Pastor, thank you for taking the time from a busy evening.
Hey, it's my pleasure to be with you.
How important is the Ortega election to the stability of Central America?
It's not very big or important. Ortega learned the importance of free rules and a democratic process in 1990. He accepted the results of an election in which he lost. He's participated in three elections since then, and he accepted the rules as well. He's not going to return back to the days of the 1980s and to a Contra war. The Cold War is over. We won. He lost. He knows that. I think he wants to try to construct a government that's responsive to the poorer people of the country, and Nicaragua certainly needs that. And if he can succeed, that would be a wonderful model for all of Central America and Latin America. And if he doesn't, we won't pay much attention to it anyway.
Now, you are a fellow and founding director of the Carter Center's Latin American and Caribbean Program. There's something going on in Central and Latin America, a shift. I mean, left and right doesn't mean anything, but for the benefit of a radio show and a discussion, let's call it a leftward swing. Chavez in Venezuela, Lula in Brazil, who's very different. He stabilized things. Bolivia has gone what we could say left. What does that mean, if anything, or are these left-wing governments really not interrelated?
They're not really interrelated. I think the old left-right spectrum, which we've become comfortable with during the Cold War, is not terribly instructive today. The way to think about Latin America is to think about it in several different groups of people or countries. You first have social democratic left, like Europe, like the Progressive Liberal Party, perhaps in Canada, in the southern part of South America, in Brazil, in Argentina, in Chile, in Uruguay. This is more like European left, if you will.
Right.
Secondly, you've got...
Not Chavez in Venezuela. We don't know what he is, but...
No, that's right. We're dealing with the southern part of South America.
Right.
Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Uruguay. Then you have a second group of Andean left. This represents people who are largely from indigenous groups, Indian groups that have been marginalized, that have never been part of the political process. They are, in effect, the product of democracy's success, which, as we know, is supposed to find ways to incorporate people that haven't been incorporated in the political process. And that's what's happened in Bolivia with Evo Morales. That's what's happening in Ecuador and Peru, in Colombia in a slightly different way, and in Venezuela as well. The big difference with Venezuela is he's a more traditional caudillo. That's the way to think about Chavez. Not that he's a leftist or an authoritarian type.
Let's just translate the word for a listening audience. Basically, a caudillo is a boss.
Caudillo is a historical boss of Latin America. It's a guy who it's Fidel Castro. The way to think about Fidel Castro, he's not a leftist, although he is, but primarily he is a caudillo. He is the chief of Cuba, and that's what Chavez aspires to. Chavez is quite unique because he also has so much oil that what he chooses to do, he can make happen. Then beyond that, you've got Central America, which is democratic right now and which is groping for a way out of economic stagnation. You've got a democratic Caribbean, and you've got Mexico, which is a part of North America, one of three countries in North America, Canada being the other, with the United States.
You almost sound optimistic, so I've got to ask you the last question. I know your time is pressed. For yet a third hat that you wear, which is director of the Center of North America for North American Studies, American University, all this discussion that we've been seeing, it's almost been a sub rosa discussion of a new North American, at least economic union or bloc between Canada, America, and Mexico without even asking the people about it. How real is this, and is this a counterweight to whatever's happening in South America?
Well, it's certainly quite distinct from the rest of South America. And indeed, the three economies of North America represent 90% of the economy of all of the Americas. So this is also the largest free trade area in the world.
That's even when you X out Venezuelan oil?
Even when you put Venezuelan oil aside.
And Brazil's GDP.
Absolutely. 90% is the three countries of North America. Mexico's GDP is bigger than Brazil's, and certainly larger than Venezuela's and Argentina as well. So you have the three biggest economies all together. You have the biggest free trade area in the world, larger than the European Union in terms of gross product in North America. The trade among the three countries of North America is the highest among any three countries in the world. So you do have a very different unit than the rest of the Americas. And where the three countries are going, it's hard to say. I just actually met with Felipe Calderon. I spoke with him about his conversations with Stephen Harper in Ottawa and asked, is this a new opportunity to get back on the trail of trying to deepen integration among the three countries in North America? He said that is his aspiration. What's happening in North America is, of course, economic and social integration is moving faster than the three governments. The three governments haven't really responded. They don't have a clear plan. They don't have much leadership towards North America as a whole. But the economies are integrating and the peoples are integrating in a remarkable way. But like with any large market, at some point, you need the three governments to step in and say, we need to work out transportation that's better. We need to do a lot of things to make the three economies work much more competitively in the world and to secure our three countries as well.
Dr. Robert Pastor, Vice President of International Affairs at American University, thank you very much for your time tonight.
It's my pleasure, Beryl. It's good talking with you.
Good talking to you, and hope to see you again soon at another conference. Montreal will be right back. We've been around the world and back tonight. We've looked at Afghanistan. We've looked at Central America. We've looked at the American elections. We're living in interesting times, and we hope it's not going to end up being the old Chinese curse. But one thing that all these examinations of nation building, democracy in action, the striving for involvement in all people's struggle for redemptive change has proved, that we have to reflect on what the French poet Paul Valéry once wrote, that la liberté est l'épreuve la plus dure que nous pouvons infliger sur les gens. Savoir comment être libre n'est pas donné à tous les hommes et toutes les nations également. Freedom, liberty, is a test that is the most difficult that we can inflict on a people. To know how to be free, to know how to live free, is not given to all people nor to all nations equally. That is the lesson, not just as we look at governments, but that is the lesson that we need to look at in our own lives, in our own everyday lives, as government makes policies that may encroach on them, encroach on our rights to privacy, encroach on our freedoms of expression and assembly. And that's what the whole bubbling experiment in freedom and electioneering is about. And no one should lose heart, because every morning that you wake up, you have two choices, to live from fear or to live from courage. Therefore, choose courage. We'll be back with you tomorrow night. My thanks to Nick Mays and Jess Connell in Master Control. Good night.